Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. On this edition, we have a report from India on the breakdown in the ranks of the Indian military. We also have an exclusive interview with one of Burma's top envoys on the violence that has struck Rakhine State. And Singapore's Prime Minister addresses the anti-foreign sentiment in the city-state. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The Indian Army's top brass is grappling with a breakdown of discipline among a number of key combat units. There's growing concern that the root cause of trouble is the failure of leadership and a drop in quality of recruits to the officers' corps. Murari Krishna has the story.
In the last 3 months, General Bikram Singh, the Army Chief, has been quietly visiting units and army bases across the country and addressing troops. His message to India's over 1 million strong army has been an emphasis on the core values of a disciplined army and a renewed stress on officer-soldier relations. The message assumes significance in the light of 3 major incidents of troop indiscipline. In a relatively short span of 8 months, there has been serious breakdown in order in army units located in sensitive areas. Earlier this month, there were reports of a standoff between officers and men from 16 Cavalry located at Samba in Jammu and Kashmir, close to the border with Pakistan. In early May, there was a huge brawl at Nyoma, close to the line of actual control in eastern Ladakh, when troops from an artillery unit clashed with officers. This resulted in the unit's commanding officer, 2 majors and some soldiers being hospitalized with serious injuries. Army headquarters described the clash, the worst of its kind since some units mutinied in 1984, as an incident of indiscipline, not a mutiny. There was yet another skirmish prior to this. Major General Ashok Mehta says there are issues relating to the officer-man relationship.
All 3 incidents were in Jammu and Kashmir. Although the visible manifestation of the problem might have been not granting leave or otherwise, the basic issue that comes out of any cases of collective indiscipline reflect the fact that the officer-man management, those relations have snapped.
What has been worrisome is that all incidents were related to combat units. Strategic analyst Saurabh Joshi, who runs a military and strategic affairs website, says more needs to be done to provide effective leadership.
This is primarily a failure of leadership. This sad state of affairs has come about because of a drop in the quality of the officers who are being recruited and taken into the army. That is something that has to be looked at. These are changes that they need to recognize.
Lieutenant General R.K. Sani, a former deputy chief, concurs but said the situation was not that bad.
Ultimately, the responsibility of seeing that the discipline and the well-being of the men is looked after by the officers, and the commanding officer becomes most important. So the 3 cases ultimately been found out to be because of the command failure, actually. So that is being looked into. But this is not very alarming. Point is, it is of course a pointer. The army has to be very conscious about. But I won't say that the discipline has broken down.
Life in the army is tough, often confining officers and men in remote areas under adverse climatic and operational conditions, where the risk to life is immense. Some say acts of indiscipline or violence is directly proportional to stress levels. Stress in the army personnel has been attributed to aspects like risk to life, threat of enemy, hardships faced, and the feeling of loneliness. So far this year, 70 suicides have been reported. Mr. Joshi believes that the army leadership must resort to a course correction to prevent further incidents.
Troops are more educated, they are more connected, they are more aware. This is not the Indian Army of 20 years back. The leadership of the army needs to recognize that and deal with that course correction, because, I mean, I fear that this could happen again. And more problematically, the issue is that these instances are taking place not in a peace station. They're taking place in sensitive locations. Those deployments are extremely important.
Following the incidents, the army brass is now trying to create the right environment for the soldiers to work and provide that healing touch. This is Murali Krishnan in New Delhi.
In Burma since May, dozens have been killed. Thousands of Muslims and Buddhist homes in Rakhine State have been destroyed. And foreign media have been barred after the Burmese government declared a state of emergency. The treatment of the Rohingya minority, regarded by many Burmese as illegal immigrants, continues to cause concern around the world. And Indonesia is sending the former Vice President Jaffa Kali to the region as its special envoy. Radio Australia's Karen Snowden has been talking to Burma's ambassador to Australia, Paul Nguyen Sien, in this rare interview. She asked him for the Burmese government's view on why tensions between Muslims and Buddhists in the country persist.
The Rakhine State conflict is actually based on the communal conflicts only, not relating to the religious matter. This is a very important point. But some people are highlighting that this is between the clash of Buddhist and Muslim or something like that. It's totally wrong. It is just the local people. But local people are also, some are Buddhism, some are Muslims, but they live together a long time already. It's a harmony and peace. But talking about some Rohingya is not in our country before, because if we go back to the history of this problem, actually it was in 1824, the British forces, they brought the Bengali people. They are not Rohingya at that time. They are Bengali people, and they came into our country. They occupied those regions, Rakhine State.
But now, are they not citizens? Does the Burmese government want them to leave?
Those generations now already the citizens of Myanmar people. We are not rejecting the people as our citizens. Even some people now, they don't have the citizenship. We have the immigration department is also accepting. If you have the evidence that you stay in our territory, since when, and they can apply for the citizenship.
Does the government need to do more to ease the community tensions?
Yeah, the government is trying the utmost effort not to get such a kind of problem, which is really very sensitive and very important issues. So we are doing bilateral cooperation with the Bangladesh, and also we are cooperating with the international organization, UN, and at the same time we are cooperating with the international NGO group.
And in the longer term, I suppose, there would be calls to improve the economic and social integration, perhaps, of this community. Are there concrete policies to develop economically those communities?
Surely. The country is now the providing those area much more, and the government is also inviting everybody, including the OIC and some international organization group to there, and they are doing the humanitarian assistance and rehabilitation, everything.
Is the Burmese government happy with the international reception so far to its quite remarkable reforms?
We are very pleased to rejoin the international community. The international community also welcomed our transformation.
The situation of sanctions remains a bit of a cloud still hanging over Burma, with some countries maintaining some of those. Is that situation changing fast enough for your liking?
Yeah, sanction is really a great barrier for our development. That is why we are requesting the international financial institution and also the country who made sanctions on our country to lift as soon as possible.
What are the specific impacts of the remaining sanctions on the people of Burma?
You know, sanctions, it's a barrier in everything, like trade and investment. Sanctions doesn't work. Cooperation and engagement beneficial for both sides.
Is there any intention by the Burmese government to wind back the military's involvement in the economy directly? Sections of the military own a lot of businesses. As the economy opens up, is there any need to review that situation from the Burmese government point of view?
Yeah, we are transforming not only the government system, but also the economic transformation, social transformation. We are not the old government anymore. we are now the civilian government, and the military side is still, they are doing their own duty. Everything are trying to privatize right now.
Well, the ADB has come out and said that Burma will be the next big thing economically in Asia as it progresses. Is that putting a lot of expectation on a country that has still a long way to go?
Yeah, actually, you know, Myanmar was really a great country around about in the 1950s, 60s. At that time, the international community, they thought that the first tiger of Asia would be Myanmar, Burma at that time. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. We are hoping for the best, but at the same time, the realities, we still need to do many, many things.
When I visited Myanmar some years ago, one of the great concerns of people I spoke to was the health system. Because it had been unsupported, it was failing to deliver public health. Are there direct policies now? Is the government in a position to redress some of those shortcomings?
Yeah, exactly. That is why the new government now focusing on education and health reform, but also by the cooperation of the regional and international community, including Australia. It's focusing on health and education sector.
And what's the budget allocation for, say, health this time around?
Actually, I don't know in the detail, but health and education surely maybe all double or triple.
Looking more regionally and Burma's place in ASEAN and Asia, many countries are reassessing the shifting economic, strategic, defence issues around the region, given the rise of China, the US's role, and things like that. Is Burma, in a similar fashion, reassessing its relationship with China?
Everything is changing each and every day and every time, every second. Myanmar cannot stay alone. But now that we are reviewing everything and we are moving in accordance with the time and changes of the world. So that many people are talking about nowadays the rise of China, and the United States are also focusing the importance of Asia Pacific. So those are also the important factors that we have to take into account. So we are also watching and learning, and at the same time we are doing the appropriate strategy and tactics to reach the regional and international goals.
This may put you on the spot. I apologise in advance. But many people have speculated, I think, about Myanmar's relationship with China and how close it was, it seemed, until recently when there were some significant changes of direction, the building of the dam and a few other infrastructure projects coming under question, which raised questions in the international community of whether or not Burma had felt it was being influenced, perhaps, or China had too high expectations, if I could put it that way, I'm not sure. Can you clarify that for us?
For me, our foreign policy is based on the five principles of peaceful coexistence. We have a very special relationship with our neighboring country, including China. Now, we had a
Did
very...
Did it change?
No, not exactly, but we do have some other priorities among our region and also the whole world, so that we give priority in some other areas. But normally we can say the relationship with China is still keep maintained as a good neighbor.
That was Radio Australia's Karen Snowden speaking to the Burmese ambassador to Australia, Pao Lam Sin. Rising anti-foreigner sentiment in Singapore was a major theme in Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's annual National Day rally speech. He gently chastised the people anonymously using the internet to express anti-foreign sentiment, saying that this can only hurt the city-state's global reputation. But unlike the paternalistic leadership in the past, Mr. Lee seemed to be reaching out to his people. We have this story from Kandahar Sapati.
In his National Day speech, Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong called on Singaporeans to help write the next chapter of the Singapore story based on three themes: hope, heart and home. Last year, when the ruling PAP won its lowest ever margin in general elections, it was a wake-up call to the government to address the people's concerns over the exponential growth in migrants. Migrants were blamed for the rising costs in housing, social services, transport, and even falling job and educational opportunities. In his National Day speech, Mr. Lee addressed some of these issues, announcing two new universities, preschools, paternal leave, and even grants for singles to buy government-commissioned homes. And to keep the dialogue going, ministers would be holding national conversations with people at the grassroots on issues of concern to them. So are we seeing a change in the style of leadership? Ravi Philamon, a community worker, activist and the former editor of Online Citizen, says these national conversations are not new. They have been a feature since the 1980s, but often they have been more rhetoric than reality. But he says this time, though, the situation may be different.
The old social contract that PAP has with Singapore is fast fraying around the edges. Many issues, including immigration, housing, widening income gaps, inequality, have all made many Singaporeans wonder if the trade-off of certain civil liberties in return for prosperity is a promise the PAP government cannot keep. So against this backdrop, the PAP government, I think, tries to forge a new social contract with Singaporeans, one focused on intangibles like hope, heart and home.
In July, the government announced new measures to control the inflow of foreigners while keeping the balance between the need for foreigners to offset the island's low birth rates and containing anti-foreign sentiment. But with anti-foreign sentiment still running viral on the internet, this is what Mr. Lee had to say.
It's all right to express disapproval of what's happened. It's necessary even. It's not all right to be a one-eyed dragon or to condemn all non-Singaporeans or all Singaporeans based on the actions of a few bad apples. Also, it's wrong to slam the shortcomings of others, but ignore our own transgressions.
It's a view that Ravi Philamon shares.
It's one thing to criticize the immigration policies of the government, but it's quite another to unfairly discriminate the foreigners. It's human tendency, I think, to go where you can make a better future for yourself and for your families, and that's what these foreigners have done. So you should not be criticizing the foreigners in an effort to drive up sentiments for your own Singaporeanness or nationhood or whatever.
Eugene Tan, Associate Professor of Law at the Singapore Management University, says, as a society, Singaporeans are not against foreigners, and that part of the fault for the current communal tension lies with the government.
Government policies have made it such that immigration has probably not worked to the advantage of local-born Singaporeans. And I think that's something that they're mindful of, you know, and in a way, the conversation has shifted towards trying to focus on immigration integration. Controls will always be there, but here it's really trying to get Singaporeans to see how we can make immigration work for us rather than against us.
Prime Minister Lee says building a harmonious, integrated society is a two-way process.
Singaporeans have to show a generosity of spirit to one another, including to the new arrivals. And the new arrivals also have to make the effort to embrace our values, to commit themselves to Singapore and to integrate into our community.
Professor Tan says by reaching out to the Singaporeans, Mr. Lee is calling for a change in their attitude to how they view their entitlements.
Sense of we got to where we are because of an individual's own effort. I think there's been an attempt to try to recalibrate that sort of thinking, that ultimately Singapore does need immigrants and we have to be receptive and we need to integrate the immigrants.
While that may be the case, Ravi Philamon says in a small country like Singapore, the government needs to do more than merely tell migrants to integrate with the citizens.
When you have 4 out of 10 who are foreigners, they don't have to integrate. They form their own enclave. So I think the government can do more in incentivizing the migrants to integrate the rest of the citizens.
And that was Kandahar Sapati reporting. From squabbles to over who owns batik to accusations about the treatment of migrant workers, Indonesia and Malaysia have had their fair share of disagreements over the years. Despite sharing a similar language and culture, the neighboring countries' tense relations can be traced all the way back to the 1960s, when President Sukarno opposed the very creation of Malaysia. These days, the animosity is still there, but it's getting harder to track. Richard Erwark speaks to Dr. Marshall Clark from Australia's National University. He's the co-author of Indonesia's Relationship with Malaysia, Cultural Heritage, Migrant Workers, and Politics.
Well, the nuances keep on changing from one month to the next and one year to the next. Every year there seems to be new challenges for the diplomats of the two countries to try and somehow put cold water on all the tensions that keep on arising, and the Indonesian media in particular always picks up on the latest incident. And the Malaysian media also refers to what's going on in Indonesia too. Just last year in the Southeast Asian Games, which were held in Jakarta and Palembang in South Sumatra, in Malaysia, this was seen to be a bit of a fiasco because of the Indonesian crowds. The Indonesian crowds were very vitriolic in their anti-Malaysia sentiment. If you can imagine the Malaysian soccer team, the under-23 Malaysian team, they played Indonesia twice, and both times the stadium in Jakarta was packed out, it's 100,000 fans, and both times the Malaysian national anthem was booed, hissed out and yelled at by the crowd. And if you can imagine 100,000 plus fans booing a national anthem, it's an incredible atmosphere. There were 27 Malaysians in the stadium, 11 of them on the pitch, the others were the support staff. But it was certainly a very intimidating atmosphere, and this was broadcast live on Malaysian TV stations, so Malaysians were quite aware of this anti-Malaysia sentiment. And that's just one example.
So plainly, there hasn't really been what you might call a generational change. If we go back to the beginning when Indonesia was very much opposed to the creation of Malaysia in the first place, to the point where there was armed opposition with obviously President Sukarno presiding. Plainly, it wasn't a very good starting point for relations between a long-established country and a new country, but here we are more than half a century down the track and still that animosity exists.
Well, yes. The confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia is very much led by Sukarno. He was incensed by the fact that the Malaysian nation federation was formed without Indonesian input, without input from Sukarno himself. But going back to the soccer stadiums, you'll see banners saying Konfrontasi and Ganyang Malaysia, destroy Malaysia. So to this day, you'll see this Konfrontasi era language appearing. And out the front of the Malaysian High Commission in Jakarta, there'll often be anti-Malaysia demonstrations, burning of Malaysian flags and banners referring to Sukarno's anti-Malaysian sentiment of the 1960s. It happens all the time, and if it's not, say, a soccer match, it'll be in a badminton match. But also, each time there's some incident regarding an Indonesian migrant worker, and there are many Indonesian migrant workers working in Malaysia. Could be at least 2 million, and it could be a large proportion of those are illegal workers. Many of those workers, they make a fair amount of money, so they have very positive stories to tell. But there is also a significant proportion of migrant workers who have very bad experiences in Malaysia. There have been some who've been sent back, deported, with no money in their pockets, simply dumped on a boat and sent back to Indonesia. Others return in body bags. And there are questions asked, what's happening in Malaysia to try and protect the conditions and the rights of the Indonesian migrant workers. So these are ongoing tensions. And for the Indonesians, especially the families of migrant workers, these are serious issues that many Indonesians feel that the Malaysian government in particular and the Malaysian authorities aren't treating as seriously as what they should be.
But is there perhaps a suggestion that what is happening here is that, yes, that there are very serious individual incidents that need to be looked at, but
yes,
people are perhaps using those individual incidents to stir up the pot a little bit and reignite, as it were, the animosity?
Yes, yeah, certainly, and that's true. But where there's smoke, there's fire, and each case, when you add it onto the previous case of a migrant worker who's been mistreated or comes back to Indonesia penniless, The word spreads, and enough people have these experiences to the point where the Indonesian media is very quick to pick up on the latest incident. There are other things too that have incensed Indonesians, particularly in the last few years. Throughout the Indonesian population, there's awareness that Malaysians seem keen to claim Indonesian cultural and art forms. Even though these might not necessarily be true, these allegations. In 2009, Indonesia was awarded a cultural heritage listing for Batik, and the Indonesian president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, declared this National Batik Day. This was back in 2009. Batik, as you know, is the floral shirts and fabric and textiles that you'll find throughout Indonesia, but particularly in Java. But you'll also find it in Malaysia. And this is where the problem comes into it. With UNESCO's involvement and awarding Batik as a specifically Indonesian intangible heritage form, this was felt in Indonesia to be a snub towards Malaysia. Yet there is this ongoing sense that Malaysians are laying claim to cultural heritage and art forms that are actually Indonesian, even though these claims are not necessarily true.
And that was Dr. Marshall Clark from the Australian National University. He is also the co-author of Indonesia's Relationship with Malaysia, Cultural Heritage, Migrant Labor and Politics. You can probably search for it on Google. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you'd like to let us know if you have any suggestions or story ideas, please contact us. Our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.